Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the OIS. My name is Michal Maidan. I'm director of the China Energy Programme at the Institute, and I'm joined today by two of my colleagues, James Henderson, who's a distinguished research fellow at the Institute, and Anders Hovey, who's a senior research fellow. And we are going to be talking about the expectations for COP28, which is taking place in Dubai from the 30th of November to the 12th of December. Jim and Anders, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.
Glad to be here.
Jim, can I come to you first to lay out, I guess, some of the broad expectations for COP28 and maybe to talk about some of the main themes that you think will dominate conversations in Dubai?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think the main topic of conversation, at least at the start of the COP, is going to be the global stocktake. Every 5 years, the UN kind of assesses where we are relative to the nationally determined contributions and other commitments that have been made. And that process has been ongoing now for the past couple of years and will set the foundation for the establishment of new NDCs in a couple of years' time. So there's already been a synthesis report out on the results of the global stocktake. To no one's surprise, it tells of the world that we are a long way off target. So that's not a great surprise. But the political discussion around those results, what needs to be done about that, will be a big topic for discussion. The second big topic will be, as always, around finance. The Loss and Damage Fund was a major success, or the establishment of it was a major success from COP27. There'll be more discussion about that fund and how it's going to work. There'll be more conversation about financing for the developing world. The 100 billion number that the developed world was meant to be contributing on an annual basis by 2020 has never been met. There is an expectation it will be by this COP, but we'll find out, and also talk about funding for adaptation as well. There will be not formal discussion, but certainly amongst the delegates, there'll be discussion around the role of hydrocarbons, the role of hydrocarbon producers, and fossil fuel phase out. And I think many people are hoping that phrase, certainly the phase out of unabated fossil fuels, will feature in the final communique. And I guess the final thing I'd just highlight up front is clearly geopolitics is going to have a major role to play. Relations between China and the US, the impact of the Russia-Ukraine war, the impact of course, the conflict in Gaza, and the role of the EU. So that geopolitical discussion debate is going to kind of frame the entire COP.
And since obviously China looms large in a lot of these things, that's one of the reasons that Anders is also on this podcast to talk us through the China perspective. But let me stay with you, Jim. We talked about, you mentioned the global stocktake, its significance, particularly this time round, the fact that we're way off target. And again, just to note the China dimension here, of course, is to always highlight how other countries are way off target. But when China actually undercommits and overdelivers, how do you expect some of the reactions at COP to the global stocktake to be and sort of the next steps forward?
Well, the initial reaction will be, no doubt, for the UN Secretary General Guterres to underline again that, as the phrase he used last time was, we're on a highway to hell with our foot on the accelerator. So, I mean, I'm sure he'll be saying words like that to catalyze concern and debate. I mean, the conclusion from the stocktake is that we're now on track for a world that's 2.4 to 2.6 degrees hotter than pre-industrial revolution. Now, to put that in context, back in 2010, with the policies that were then in place, were going to send us towards a 3.7 to 4.8 degree world. So things have certainly improved. However, of course, we're still well above the 1.5 to 2 degree target set in the Paris Agreement. So that problem is going to be highlighted undoubtedly, but the global stocktake doesn't just highlight problems, it also comes up with some solutions. I've already mentioned the phase out of unabated fossil fuels. That is one of the recommendations, and that will be a hot topic for debate, as will be the acceleration of the scale up of renewable energy, which has been one of the major objectives of the UAE presidency to discuss renewable energy. We'll also be discussing, or as a result of the stocktake, be discussing emissions in hard to abate sectors. So there'll be a lot of talk about transport and industry. And there'll be further discussion, and I know we're going to talk about this later, about the reduction of emissions of other high-impact greenhouse gases, particularly methane. So I think the global stocktake is going to highlight the issue. it's going to propose some broad solutions and going to set the foundation for a fairly in-depth discussion, I hope, towards what will be a final communique that hopefully includes decisions on all those issues, but also there'll be broader top discussions outside the main conference with various groups and various multilateral efforts also coming together around those topics. I mean, the other thing the Global Stocktake underlines, of course, is the vast amounts of money that need to be spent, the trillions of dollars that need to be spent, particularly in the developing world. So obviously that debate is going to be going on throughout the COP as well.
And I guess this falls into what you mentioned, the geopolitics and geopolitical dynamics, what I think the COP28 president has mentioned and blamed rich nations for their dismal failure, for holding up progress in negotiations. I think the Global South looks at the energy crisis in the Global North and some European countries going back to coal. So this kind of North versus South divide looms large and goes back to what you were just saying about loss and damage. So how does this play out at COP? Do you expect any new financing goals? Is it even worthwhile to slap on new targets when we're falling short of the existing commitments?
So I think the loss and damage fund was almost a red line at the last COP for developing countries, particularly some of the small island nations, because they were getting to the stage where they kind of felt they'd been shouting about this for so long and getting no results. So the formation of the loss and damage fund was seen as a success. However, as one delegate put it, without further action, it's just like opening a bank account with no money in it. So what's been going on over the past 12 months has been further discussions about how to make it work. And the big questions were, who should be paying money in? How should they be paying it in? And how should it be then allocated? And who is eligible to take money out? And finally, where should the fund be located? Now, that final decision has been reached because the fund looks like it's going to be located in the World Bank, which is a little bit annoying for developing countries who wanted to be under the UNFCCC. But anyway, the big debate now is who will be eligible. The definition of developing nations was set back in 1992 when Singapore was defined as a developing nation, is now one of the richest countries in the world. And China is also a developing nation. I think there's questions about the role of China with regards to this fund. You know, should it be actually contributing money, not taking money out? And then the question of the amounts of money that should be paid in, an initial number of 100 billion has been mentioned. But anyway, how much should be paid in and how it should be allocated? These are all going to be questions that are looking for answers. And if the developing world don't get those answers, then they may well be obstructive in other parts of the negotiations. On the broader topic of financing, there was this $100 billion commitment for mitigation and adaptation made back in 2009 by the developed countries for the developing world to be achieved by 2020. It wasn't achieved by 2020. It wasn't even achieved by 2022 and COP27. There is some hope that it will be achieved by this COP. It was what Sultan Al-Jaber was referring to in terms of the dismal failure you mentioned. So we'll see. But to be honest, $100 billion is almost now like an irrelevance, because the next question is, you know, that number was financing to 2025. Beyond 2025, the number goes up sort of almost exponentially. By 2030, estimates are that the developing world's going to need $1 trillion a year. So from 2025 onwards, there needs to be a new number agreed. 500 billion would seem to be the minimum then to get you towards $1 trillion by 2030. So there'll be discussion about that number, which will be largely used for financing mitigation in the developing world. And then there's the question of adaptation as well. So, you know, preparing for the impact of climate change. There is a global goal on adaptation that was established in the Paris Agreement. The funding commitment back in 2019 was $20 billion. That was doubled to $40 billion at COP26 in Glasgow. But again, the estimates by 2030 that, you know, we're going to need to be spending between $160 and $340 billion by 2030. So there's more negotiation needed there as well at COP28. So these are very big numbers, very complex, and not in just in terms of setting the target, but actually deciding who should be paying and, equally importantly, how they should be paying. The developing countries get very cross if money just gets reallocated from other development spending. And they also don't like being lent the money at high interest rates, which many have complained about. They much prefer, obviously, low interest rate loans or, best of all, grants. So debate around how the finance is provided is also going to be a major topic for the COP.
Thanks, Jim. And I want to move now to China. Obviously, one of the things you said, sort of who is a recipient, who is a contributor, is China developing or a developed nation, comes to the heart of a lot of these questions. So, Anders, can we start, first of all, just with an overview of China's stance ahead of COP28? And then perhaps if you could touch on some of its views on the global stocktake, loss and damage, before we move to, I guess, the thornier issues of the role of hydrocarbons.
You know, China has taken a variety of climate positions over the years, and I think that the most important general trend to observe is that the position on climate has become a little bit more combative in the last 2 years, and that although China has definitely made some compromises at COPs over the last few sessions, nevertheless, I think that China will be attempting to shift the burden of the global stocktake discussion more towards those other countries that have made commitments and not lived up to those commitments, in contrast to China, which has made commitments which arguably were either more long-term or less binding, but has lived up to those commitments. In Xi Jinping's memorable phrase, if you say it, do it. If you can't do it, don't say it. And I think that one thing China will be able to bring to the discussion is it should be able to bring some of the achievements that it has made in excess of what it previously committed to as offerings to the table. And as Jim, you alluded to, I think that China will be very eager to enhance its climate position vis-a-vis the other developing world countries. And China definitely does view itself as a developing country, and South-South cooperation, South-South diplomacy is a major motivation for continuing to productively engage in climate talks. So I think that the loss and damage fund, this type of issue is one where I would expect that China would be attempting to play a more constructive role, whereas I think on issues such as coal or phasing down or phasing out coal, this could be very much resisted on the Chinese side.
And I think, as you mentioned, China's more combative approach has meant that there's always been an element of the cooperative elements that it puts to the table versus the kind of struggle. And they all tie into both domestic politics and the state of China's relations with the West. But let's start with, I guess, the wins. What are the wins or the strengths, the overachievements that China will look to bring to the table and highlight at COP28?
I think the most important win that China can bring to the table is that in its official nationally determined contribution plan, the country had committed to 1,200 gigawatts combined of wind and solar photovoltaic capacity. And that capacity number is incredibly ambitious on a global scale. However, China is likely to vastly exceed that target. And indeed, even when the target was announced, China was already on track to meet the target. But in the last few years, the installation of new wind and solar has just accelerated, especially this year when China has actually already, by the end of the third quarter, installed more solar PV capacity than the United States has in total already installed at the end of last year. So the amount of capacity has overachieved, as well another area where China is ahead of its targets, although this is not a part of the nationally determined contribution, is in terms of electrification of transport. And you could imagine that China would be able to completely electrify its new passenger vehicle sales by 2030. So you could imagine that China could adopt some sort of position related to its future nationally determined contribution that could be portrayed as an increase of ambition. Now, as Jim, you mentioned that the foot is on the accelerator on our pathway to hell. You know, China is accelerating on the transition to renewables, but it is also accelerating on coal. So it's going to be, I think, challenging to portray just those feel-good measures on renewables and other aspects as an acceleration of China's climate commitment in itself. But they are nevertheless significant. And currently, with renewables rising in the overall share of electricity production and the economy electrifying industry, that does appear to be on track to meet China's plans for carbon peaking and carbon neutrality.
Before we dive into your last point about coal, just on what you were saying about China exceeding its renewables targets and having all this overcapacity, which is, of course, potentially a force of global good, right? The ability to export and its large exports of EVs and solar panels and wind turbines. And yet China is facing more investigations and potential tariffs on its exports of certainly EVs and potentially wind turbines. Will it play into COP? And if so, how does it play into those dynamics and into China's positioning?
In general, I believe that China's position will be that the various trade disputes, industrial policies adopted by other countries, investigations that you mentioned, that all of this is undermining climate cooperation, and that both the structure of climate negotiations should center on nationally determined contributions, which will be based on unique circumstances, and therefore China's policies will be based on its own unique circumstances and not on something that is a response to pressure from other countries. And that has been very clear in the recent, 6 months during various discussions with John Kerry's visit to Beijing and speeches by President Xi on whether or not China would respond to pressure or whether China would chart its own course. Comments from Xie Zhenhua about, China doesn't have any realistic way to phase out coal, that this is not a realistic strategy for China. So I do think that China will both be pushing back on efforts to, let's say, make climate more of a national policy, industrial policy on the part of countries in Europe and North America, at the same time as it will be emphasizing that its own plans are very much based on its own national circumstances.
Related to that question of the role of hydrocarbons is the discussion about transition technologies, carbon capture, utilization, storage, and methane emissions. Jim, can you talk us through the state of play on those and what you expect from COP28?
Yeah, so I think the question on CCS particularly is very relevant to the kind of future role of hydrocarbons. And it is a question about whether CCS should be seen as an essential technology in the transition, because hydrocarbons are going to be around for some time and we need to decarbonize their use, or whether, as a number of environmental NGOs argue, it is just a SOP to continue hydrocarbon production for as long as possible. Now, I think the debate is becoming more realistic. I think that the debate is becoming one where even regions like the EU now have a very important CCUS strategy. And so it's becoming more a part of the debate, as in, what do we do about the continued use of hydrocarbons, particularly in hard to abate sectors? So I think that what we're going to see at this COP is more debate around the whole issue of carbon capture technologies, more debate around what the implications therefore are for the use of hydrocarbons in the global energy sector, and inevitably debate around the role of hydrocarbon producers, obviously because this COP is being held in the UAE, which is a major hydrocarbon producer. So there will be controversy around it, but I think that the debate is going to become a little more realistic at this COP. In terms of methane emissions, that is obviously related to the whole question of hydrocarbon production, because one of the real criticisms, particularly of the gas industry, but also of the oil and coal industries, is that we are under accounting for methane leaks in the system. And so there has been a major push, and indeed the signing of the Global Methane Pledge at COP26, its reiteration at COP27, the highlighting of the issue by the COP president, Sultan Al-Jaber, as another one to be addressed. And of course, the role of China within this whole debate now, I think we are going to see some very positive moves forward on the whole question of methane emissions. So I think the final point to make on this whole issue is there is a further rather semantic but important debate around what unabated actually means, because saying the phase down of unabated fossil fuels is a goal of many people at this COP in terms of a statement in the final communique. But unabated, does that mean completely unabated? Does that mean partially unabated? It could be anything from 1% abated to 100% abated. And I think, again, there's a debate that will be had at this COP around what we mean by actually removing the carbon from hydrocarbon, both production, but also consumption. So So I think that's, we shouldn't ignore that as well, because things could get quite heated around that kind of semantic definition.
So if we go back to the issue of methane, Anders, in COP26, of course, China not signing up to the Global Methane Pledge was a big deal. But then in the US-China statements, China said that it would issue its methane action plan. It was supposed to issue it that same year and didn't. But in November, so just a couple of weeks ago, we're recording on the 13th of November, just to timestamp this, a week or so ago, China issued its long-awaited methane action plan. What does it contain and how do you think it will be perceived?
First of all, the Methane Action Plan does contain a lot of detailed provisions covering a number of different methane emitting sectors, and it does include some quantitative targets, but those targets are more related to individual sectors. For example, the methane emissions from sludge, from landfills, from poultry, from fertilizer, and the recovery of gases from coal bed mining. So the overall plan does not have a target for the amount of reduction in China's methane emissions, which the number of methane emissions are not officially published in China as at this point. So that may be the reason why. However, I think that this will be a focus of the discussion around methane at the COP and whether this action plan really meets the needs of reducing the overall emissions of methane from China. There's also no timeline. The plan does include some timing elements for when these sectoral targets need to be reached by 2025 and 2030, but most of its focus at the national level is more on monitoring, reporting, and verification. And I think it's notable that China doesn't publish its annual numbers for carbon dioxide emissions. So it would be somewhat surprising if China began publishing numbers for methane emissions if they became available. So presumably this is not something where China is planning to start publishing information or setting targets. I will note that in other action plans for other areas, other topics, those would be domestic policies, such as on air quality or air pollution. When China published its action plan on air pollution control and prevention back in 2012, 2013, that included actual targets for what the concentration of air pollution should be in various Chinese cities. And so it is feasible for an action plan to include timelines and targets for overall achievement. And this one does not include those.
Obviously, we know that with China, there's a link between unilateral action or sort of domestic policies and what it can bring to the multilateral table. Jim, with China now signing, or at least having a methane action plan and potentially signing up to a global methane pledge, that's, I guess, good news for multilateralism. Which other multilateral agreements do you think will be important to watch? The Just Energy Transition Partnership comes to mind. Again, what is its importance? How do we think about it? And what can we expect from COP28 in this context?
So I think the multilateral agreements are a pretty important element now. And that's because the final communique, although it doesn't have to be unanimous, generally there's a lot of work on getting the final communique unanimous. And therefore, some of the statements around some of the decisions that have been made have to be watered down. And we saw that at the last COP with the whole debate around whether we should phase out or phase down fossil fuels. So the multilateral agreements take on an importance because they don't obviously require unanimity and they can just be agreements between regions and countries on specific topics. And the Global Methane Pledge was a very, very good example of that, which has catalyzed a lot of action. I think there are other multilateral agreements out there around net zero emission vehicles, but you've mentioned Just Energy Transition Partnerships, and they are an important example of how developed countries and regions have come together with specific developing world countries to finance the move, particularly away from coal, towards cleaner forms of electricity. South Africa was the first example of that, where $6 to $8 billion was pledged by various countries in Europe and the EU itself and the US to help aid the transition away from coal. A $20 billion partnership has been announced with Indonesia, again, to help the move away from coal. And countries such as Vietnam and India and Senegal have also been mentioned as potential candidates for these partnerships. Now, essentially, it involves the allocation of developed world funds to these particular countries to be invested in the closing down of coal-fired plants and investment into renewable electricity and all the social and economic consequences that that involves. There are still questions around how that finance is provided. Again, the question of whether they're grants or loans and what the interest rates are and, you know, how rapidly money is being provided and whether it's really new money or money being reallocated from other development funds. But nevertheless, I think more announcements like that just demonstrate that concrete action can come out of COPs. It won't necessarily be concrete action from a kind of unilateral global pledge, but it is specific regions taking specific steps with developing world countries to aid them in the transition process.
So if we shift gears a little bit from, I guess, the multilateral to the bilateral, and US-China obviously comes to mind here. We just talked about the methane action plan, China's methane action plan that was announced while China's chief negotiator Xie Jianhua was in the US meeting with John Kerry. So, Anders, is the methane action plan, or sort of how does it fit into the broader US-China relationship to the climate momentum in relationship, if we can call it climate momentum? How will that factor into COP28? Do you think it's a positive? Do you think it's a neutral sort of element in this negotiation? How do we think about this?
It's a neutral to mildly positive development. It is certainly upholding a commitment, albeit belatedly. And, the recent lack of very negative news, at least at the global headline level, regarding the U.S.-China relationship specifically, along with the possible visit of Xi to the United States to meet with Biden and to attend conferences in California, that all points to a brief period of normality in the relationship between the United States and China. And climate, of course, has been one of the most reliable ways that the two countries can have dialogue and discussion and show some sort of progress. Of course, the Inflation Reduction Act, the industrial policy, and the rhetoric from both sides has not exactly gone away. And so I wouldn't expect any dramatic change or dramatic U-turn or major announcement on climate to come out of that, let's say, absence of major negative news headlines. And definitely within China, the global situation is still seen as very difficult for China to envision sort of a total normalization of relations between the United States and China or participation in climate talks as truly a multilateral forum.
I guess on that broader geopolitical tensions and questions, Jim, you mentioned this at the outset. How will geopolitics impact this year's COP? Will it be a fragmenting element, or could it, on the contrary, be a galvanizing, we're in a crisis mode globally. Could it be galvanizing for climate action? So how do you think geopolitics plays into this year's COP?
I mean, unfortunately, I don't think it's going to be galvanizing. I think what I hope is that it won't get in the way too much. I guess I would just to underline points that Anders just made. You can't understate the importance of the relations between John Kerry and Xi Jinping at the COPs. The last two COPs have essentially got going when those two were allowed to get together and have conversations. And if they can be seen to be talking, even if nothing particularly substantive comes out of it, that creates a momentum for the rest of the COP. The world's two biggest economies and two biggest emitters sitting down to talk about the environment does get other people talking about it in a positive way as well. So I hope that those two can provide some positive momentum. In terms of other geopolitics, I mean, clearly conflict in Gaza is not going to help, given it's located near by COP28 and involves, doesn't involve, but, has ramifications for the region. But, I mean, hopefully that won't disturb things too much. The other, obviously, ongoing major conflict is Russia in Ukraine, and we'll have to see whether that creates dividing lines. Russia has already said it will refuse to support any major statements on the phase-out of fossil fuels. So, again, if it brings other Global South countries with it on that who are also neutral or even supportive of Russia's position on other geopolitical issues, then that could create some dividing lines. And I think the final point to raise is probably the role of the EU. I mean, historically, the EU has been seen as something of a climate champion. Clearly, its actions in the last 18 months around hydrocarbons haven't helped that at all. And, you know, countries like the UK, obviously not part of the EU, but I mean, in Europe, being seen as backtracking on some climate issues, again, is not helping. And, you know, the EU is also talking about this carbon border adjustment mechanism, which would have an impact on global trade and has caused some friction as well. So I think the role of the EU, not in obviously as part of a conflict, but just more generally as a political actor, will also be something to follow, because there could be some significant criticism if it starts to get too evangelical about environmental issues at this COP.
I'm going to cling to the first point that you made about US-China potentially providing some positive momentum at this COP, because it does sound like a very complicated, to put a nice word on it, COP that's coming up. I'm afraid that that's all the time we have for today, but I would like to thank both of you, Jim and Anders, for joining me. You will find all of our COP-related research and podcasts on the OIS website. We will have a podcast on the outcomes of COP in the next month or so. So we hope you will join us for that. And just to you, our audience, thank you very much for joining us. And we hope you will join us for the next discussions.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.